Good evening. I'm Renee Barrio, the McNay's Chief Curator and Curator of Art after 1945. I'd like to welcome you to tonight's overview of contemporary art by Dr. Andy Campbell, the first presentation in a three-part series titled Contemporary Crash Course. Contemporary Crash Course is organized in conjunction with the exhibition Majority Rules, A Decade of Contemporary Art Acquisitions, which is on view through September 15th in our Frost Galleries. First, I just want to acknowledge and thank my colleagues in the Education Department, Kate Carey and Liz Lloyd, for all their hard work on this programming. Andy Campbell is a senior lecturer in art history at Texas State University in San Marcos. There he teaches courses on feminism and visual representation, video activism and the AIDS pandemic, graphic novels, bad taste, and, which is germane to this, issues in contemporary art. Dr. Campbell received a BA in art history from Oberlin College and then an MA and a PhD in art history from the University of Texas at Austin. His writings have appeared in a range of journals, newspapers, online publications, and exhibition catalogs. So the title for this evening's presentation is For Anyone, For Anyone. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Andy Campbell to the McNay Art Museum.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm going to repeat the thanks. Thank you to Liz. Thank you to Renee and to the McNay and to you for showing up. I am really pleased and thrilled to be here. I don't like standing behind podiums, so I'm going to be kind of pacing around in front for you. For your entertainment. I'm so glad that you put the emphasis on the question mark and the exclamation point. And I'll talk about where the title for this lecture comes from in just a second. But I want to briefly explain a couple things about myself. People come to contemporary art in all kinds of ways. And for me, the way that I came to contemporary art was through Christian art, actually. I'm Jewish. I was born and raised Jewish. And my initial encounter with art history was in the context of learning first about the great Christian art of the Renaissance era. Now, the kids that I was in the high school class with, they already knew something about Jesus Christ and about the story of Christ and about the New Testament. I knew next to nothing other than once a year people made a big deal about Santa Claus and I saw it everywhere, and there were no menorah anywhere. That was kind of my relationship to Christianity. So I actually approached Christian art as someone would approach Greek mythology, something that was unfamiliar, a fun story to be learned, something that could potentially impact me in terms of not my personal belief systems, but what I wanted to learn from the world. And I think that that actually was formative for myself in thinking about contemporary art. By the way, I will say that what I'm about to kind of tell you about the way that people normally, I've noticed people normally react to contemporary art is just as true here as it is anywhere else. In fact, I was walking around the galleries earlier before my talk, and there was a family in front of the Leonardo Drew sculpture that's in the sculpture court, which I think is really fabulous. But one of them kind of started shaking their heads and said, like, now I just don't know why that's art, you know? And I think that that's a really great starting point if people kind of move towards trying to answer that question. So what I notice is that most people encounter a work like this. This is Robert Gober's Drain. And they just kind of shake their heads and walk away, maybe chuckle to themselves, right? And maybe turn heel and go. I think art history, and especially contemporary art, is like any other discipline, which means that you get out of it what you put into it. So part of what we expect art to do for us is to speak directly to us immediately. And I think that's a pretty heavy burden for art to carry, actually. I think that art works best when we come to it with a spirit of openness and generosity, and when we learn a little bit about its context. So if you know a little bit about art history, you have kind of a frame to place Robert Gober's sculpture in. One obvious link would maybe be Marcel Duchamp's urinal fountain, right? Which is this kind of seminal artwork that gets reproduced over and over and over again in histories of European modernism. It is the moment, or one of the moments, where artists kind of make a shift and say, art is not what you hand make, it is rather what you choose. It is rather what you seek to display, what you point to, rather than what you kind of technically, precisely make or handcraft. Now, Marcel Duchamp was kind of being a provocateur. He was making a joke. And Robert Gober is kind of doing the inverse of Marcel Duchamp. Whereas Marcel Duchamp bought a urinal, a mass-produced urinal, flipped it on its side, signed it with a pseudonym, and called it art, Robert Gober takes the humble, everyday drain and actually re-sculpts it, handcrafts it, and then casts it. So he doesn't take the mass marketed object. Rather, he tries to create that very same object with exactitude and precision and places it, installs it on the wall at like belly button height usually. So it has a kind of anthropomorphic, human-like kind of quality. So knowing a little bit about, say, the history of art or art's context helps us to not just kind of turn heel and go the other way. Now, the title of today's lecture comes from a back-and-forth exchange, really a kind of visual and textual exchange between Morley Safer of 60 Minutes and Jerry Saltz, who's the art critic for New Yorker. Morley Safer did a piece in 1993, and then he did another one in 2012. The 1993 piece was called Yes, But Is It Art? Right? And he looked at the kind of art world as it exists in the marketplace. So he found what he called the emperor's new clothes, examples of art speak, that's jargon that people like me talk, that no one can understand. And he found this to be all so much invisible tower building. He found this to be an example of a culture that was full of itself, that didn't know what it was looking at, that had no relationship to reality or the people that interact with art whatsoever. Now, I come from an education background. I live my life in education. And so Morley Safer's question, yes, but is it art, is actually the one question when I teach contemporary art at Texas State that I ban from the classroom. And this is really interesting for me because I think that it's actually a red herring question. I don't actually think that's a really productive question to ask. Yes, but is it art? I think a much more productive way to phrase that is, when we consider this art, it does XYZ. When we consider the ramifications of this being art, what happens? Right? So the question isn't, do I believe, do I not believe in art? Is it the emperor's new clothes, or is it actually some great meaningful thing? Right? It's actually about kind of contemplation, about placing it in a context, thinking about it in relationship to artists and their practice. I'm someone who tends to, and you know, call me Pollyanna-ish if you want, but I tend to kind of come down on the side of artists. I don't think artists are trying to fool anyone inherently. I think artists are trying to enter into a conversation with the world and with themselves and with their immediate circles. And so I find it most interesting to try to join that conversation or to find out what that conversation may or may not be about. So that's kind of by way of introducing not only a kind of general take on contemporary art so that you know a little bit more about me, but also to kind of start by asking some critical questions of the business of looking at contemporary art. I think it's interesting to think about what happens when we ask what do people expect from art. And there are many artists who have made projects based off of what people expect from contemporary art. This is Komar and Melamed's America's Most Wanted painting. What they did is they actually hired a polling agency to poll people from the United States and other countries what they most wanted to see in art. And so they actually statistically divided up the results and they made that painting, right? So what you have is literally, or kind of tongue-in-cheekily, right, America's Most Wanted Painting. Now, what's so interesting about America's Most Wanted Painting is that it's really boring. And it is also kind of funny, too, because Americans, they like landscapes, obviously. They like bucolic scenes, but they also like historical figures. So Comar and Melamedes place George Washington right in the middle of this kind of landscape. And I think that this is an example of two artists not making fun of, say, American values, because they did this kind of thought experiment, this painting experiment, across many different countries with many different groups of people, but rather thinking about what are our own limitations to kind of thinking about what we want from art that surrounds us, right? One of the statements that I zero in on that they asked in their polling was, and that they found 75% of the people that they polled in America to think, is that paintings don't necessarily have to teach us any lessons, but can just be something a person likes to look at, which is a really nice thought, actually. And I believe that as well. But I also think that there's some value in kind of thinking about challenging work as well. I actually teach about Thomas Kincaid in my bad taste class. I actually like thinking with Thomas Kincaid because I find it to be really interesting, and I think it's actually a lot more complicated, and I'm not going to make a kind of rip one-liner joke on Thomas Kincaid, because I actually think that it's much more complex than many people would kind of give it credit for. It is pictures of bucolic landscapes manufactured with kind of overt or subtle Christian themes, and there is this way that it connects to kind of the American dream, or rather the American ideal of itself. And we can see that in the ways that Thomas Kincaid's paintings have been turned into, say, actual living communities. This is the village at Hiddenbrook, which is a gated community intentionally modeled after Thomas Kincaid's art near Vallejo, California. And what's so interesting about this, and I want to kind of point your eye towards this, is the difference between the kind of ideal of what we're aiming for and kind of what we end up with, right? And I think this is also, this taps into, for me, a larger conversation about how we value images, where we place them. And it also, it's a way for me, when I bring up these examples in the classroom, it's a way for me of teaching students how to discern, by the way, this is the least wanted painting. It's this little paperback size, geometric abstract thing. But when I bring up these examples, it's a way in the classroom for me to start teaching students how to discern what is maybe more interesting to look at and think with, and what may not be as interesting to look at and think at. I don't think that anything intrinsically is not interesting to think with, as I've just shown with Thomas Kincaid. But I do think that we can think about where artists are coming from, how they're entering into conversation. So one of the kind of object lessons I use is these two paintings together. One, both are actually produced by local Texas gay white men who work in painting and portraiture, okay? So they share a lot in terms of identity and background. They're of the same generation. They share a lot in terms of their identification, the way they sometimes they move in the world. But they're radically different in terms of the way that they approach this kind of genre of portrait painting. So Graydon Parrish, who's on the right, makes no bones about the fact that he kind of pulls from academic painting from the turn of the last century, that he finds a lot of value and a lot of pride in a kind of technical mastering of kind of painting skills. In fact, he kind of paints in this kind of mode all the time. Now, what's so interesting about his choice of historical referent is that at the time that, say, Bouguereau was painting, we also have the rise of kind of early modernists like Manet and kind of nascent French modernism. So Bouguereau and Bouguereau's circle was really the rear guard of art making at the time. They weren't doing, say, what was kind of pushing the boundaries of art forward. So what's interesting is that Graydon Parrish is kind of calling back to this specific rear guard. Now, he doesn't necessarily make any additional changes to that formula. They tend to be academic portraits. They tend to be in a kind of framework of a muse. Whereas I think that for me, at least, as a kind of thinker in contemporary art, there's a little more bite and stuff to think with in terms of Hyde Fontenot's paintings. Now, Fontenot is a portrait painter as well. He represents people of all shapes and sizes in his painting, and he actually makes everyone look really good and cute, regardless of their shape or size, which I think is a very particular kind of painting representational challenge. But he also plays with material, so he paints on thin wooden board, which actually harkens back to earlier histories of painting, where oil paintings were made on panel, right, instead of canvas. So he's kind of building a whole history of reference, and there's this kind of relationship between his subject and the viewer. There's this kind of insouciance to the look of Johnny, right? He's kind of got his hands on hips and looking out at the viewer. Now, this is a picture of the artist's partner. So this is also a kind of portrait of, in some respects, a relationship as well. And it's been framed out very lightly with this kind of pencil cameo frame. So there's this kind of movement from the wood grain to the pencil, to the drawing, to the actual finished product of the portraiture. And there's an interesting kind of subject-object relationship in this kind of a painting. So that's, again, this is all kind of by way of introduction. I think there are other artists who kind of play with and deal with generic conventions such as landscape. One of them makes her home right here in San Antonio, Joey Farso. A recent video that she produced in 2010 called The Clearing, where she plays a kind of flute, I guess a very beautiful, romantic kind of piece of music while a young male kind of dancer spins and falls to the ground, and reversing a kind of gendered role of the kind of male player and the female nude muse. So there's a kind of relationship with history here, and here's the guy spinning around. It's really great. It's really fun. And I also like to think of what happens when we think of things that we might not associate with kind of generic conventions, like this work by Monica Bonvicini, with something like a landscape convention. The landscape is different. It's the urban landscape, the urban poor landscape. It's made with the cheapest materials possible, say a spray paint can directly on the wall. But it's no less direct in the way that it's playing with those generic conventions, right? Add elegance to your poverty and showing the white picket fence. Right, it's a pretty cynical and somewhat sad take on what kind of the American dream is, the white picket fence. And yet, for me, this kind of hits home. You know, being of a certain class background myself, I think, you know, there's a way that we gussy up ourselves in terms of class that may not actually reflect our own kind of ideals or backgrounds. And this, to me, speaks just as much to, say, a genre of landscape painting as does Joey Farso's work, or Hyde or Graydon's work speaks towards a kind of portrait genre. Okay. So I'm going to kind of talk about different areas of concern. And I'm going to use one work from the exhibition that I'm here to kind of talk in conjunction with to kind of lead off each of these sections. So the sections are as follow: originality, authorship, media, medium, identity, politics, and desire and history. So this is meant to be a crash course, so I'm going to go fast, okay? And there will be time for questions at the end. So if you have a question, just kind of hold it in your mind, and we can always go back at the end of the presentation. But I'm going to use these four particular works to kind of think with and use to jump off into these sections. And I wanted to really highlight what I consider to be something very special about the Collector's Forums pick, which is that, to me, they have a kind of inherent racial and gender diversity that is really lovely to see in terms of a kind of semi-democratically elected, you know, process. I think it's really nice to see that it's not just kind of white dude's painting that's represented, that it's more actually diverse than that. And so I'm actually highlighting the areas where specifically identity politics come into play, but also where issues of media and authorship come into play. So you'll see these guys again. They'll come right back up. So I'm going to start with originality and authorship. And this is actually where I like to start my contemporary art class, because it is the one thing that I think most young artists who are going to art school hold very deeply and dear and assume about themselves, which is that they are in control of their messaging and that they are ultimately the author and the original creator of their work, which is a very difficult thing to kind of pry apart. And I like to begin with my students from a place of instability instead of a place of stability. I think that's actually a productive place of learning, because I think that it's in instability where people actually make their thoughts known, where people are able to kind of have difficult conversations with themselves and those around them. And I find that it facilitates class discussion in a room full of 80 people a lot better than, say, if I started with something that was clearly... and in the eyes of everybody in that room, quote unquote, safely art, right? So the image that I'm going to use from the show to lead off this section is the amazing and amazingly large photograph by Vic Muniz, which is a part of his Pictures in Pigment series. So it's a photograph taken of a pigment redrawing, or maybe a scattering of pigment, of a Piet Mondrian painting of a windmill in sunlight. And so what the artist did is he kind of used the template of Piet Mondrian's windmill painting and then actually placed individual grains of pigment, which are, as we know, the basis, along with oil, linseed, walnut oil, to oil paint, and actually kind of repainted just with the pigment powder this image. And he's photographed it in such a way that you can really see almost each individual grain of pigment. It's really spectacular. But when we approach a work like this, inevitably, it comes up that, hey, he didn't really do that picture, right? He didn't really come up with that composition. He's just kind of reformatting it, or he's just kind of reviewing it, remaking it. And that's true, actually. And what we see when we look at a Vic Muniz photograph is we see what can happen when we play with and reformat, rephotograph, recontextualize the images that already surround us. Now, with Vic Muniz, it's really interesting because there's a kind of virtuosity to his kind of artistic performance. So the way that he lays down chocolate or sugar or trash or pigment or newsprint, you can tell that there's a lot of very dedicated and minute work in kind of making the image. It's harder for students, I think, to approach appropriation artists like Sherry Levine and really think about them as kind of doing their own thing. So what you're looking at are ostensibly three images that are exactly the same. The first image was taken by Walker Evans in coordination with James Agee, as they wrote the kind of infamous documentary book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. And this concerned a kind of Depression-era folks in the South who were kind of living by the skin of their teeth. And oftentimes the book was reprinted with Walker Evans's photographs kind of in the beginning of the book. So James Agee talks about three particular families. It's three particular families that are photographed by Walker Evans. And so oftentimes we look at Walker Evans' photograph as documentary evidence of something like the Great Depression or the Dust Bowl. Now, Sherry Levine, in her artistic practice, actually re-photographs, mostly photographs, by other artists. So what she does is she actually photographs the reproductions of the photographs themselves. So I know this is a little wonky, but try to follow me. So the image, the photograph, has been printed. It is then reprinted and distributed in a book. So it's mediated once, okay, or twice, as it were. So from film to printing, from printing to bookmaking, right? Sherry Levine then takes a picture of that image in the book and reprints it and titles it, leaving no doubt as to where she's taking the image from, right? This is very important. She doesn't just kind of take the image and then say, this is Ali Mae Burroughs, right? No, she says, after Walker Evans, you know where it comes from, right? She does this with a very select group of artists. They happen to mostly be European modernists and mostly men. So there's a little bit of a kind of critique of gender here and of the making of art or of great art by specific sets of genders, right? So by focusing her gaze on specific sets of images, she's recontextualizing it, perhaps embedding a kind of critique in it. Now, Eric Doerringer, who's an artist in New York City, has taken that one step further and rephotographed Sherry Levine's photograph. And he's rephotographed it for his bootleg series, which he sells in New York City outside of galleries, as you would perhaps buy a fake Fendi purse on Canal Street in New York City. His reproductions, his bootlegs, his art bootlegs, I think they're anywhere between $60 and $250. So when Eric Doerringer, let's go back. You'll see this in just a second. Oh, you're getting a preview. So the first image is documentary, the second image is maybe a critique of gender, the third image may be about market and about the way that people buy and consume work, right? So the same image can communicate different things each time. So this is kind of the tactic, the artistic tactic of appropriation, of taking an image and recontextualizing it. There's a kind of growing debate in the field of performance art about how this applies in the case of performance art. And one of the kind of artists who's leading the charge and kind of speaking out about it or thinking about it, proposing some solutions about it, is Marina Abramović. And she's actually reperformed or had her own works reperformed in addition to performing or reperforming the works of other performance artists. So what you're looking at here is, on the left, a still shot of a performance that Marina Abramović did with her partner in life and art, Ulay, and they stood naked at a very narrow entrance to the gallery. So for viewers to enter into the gallery show, they had to twist either one way and face one of the genders of the artist and then move beyond. And in fact, you'll notice how close they are to each other and how people cannot avoid touching the artist, which for many people might be a very uncomfortable thing to do, right? This is part of a kind of provocation of contemporary art. Meanwhile, Marina and Ulay are kind of staring directly into each other's eyes and trying to connect while everybody is kind of moving past them. Now, for her recent solo show at the Museum of Modern Art in 2010, she restaged these performances. She herself was performing downstairs, but restaged some of her most important performances with young performance artists. But you'll notice in the restaging how far apart the bodies are, right? So they're not really that close together. And this is also not at the entrance to the exhibition. This was at a place where you could either choose to go through or not, right? So the meanings, just by reperforming the work, by resetting it, by placing the actors farther apart, all of a sudden it's not, it may be still anxiety producing for you, I have no idea, but it's not as anxiety producing. You don't have to move past them to get somewhere, right? You can choose whether or not to interact or not. And that may signal a shift in the way that we've come to think about how radical performance art can be or how radical it can't be. She's also proposed that performance artists should be trying to reperform the work of their predecessors, of course, and she kind of lays this out very clearly, with the blessing and the payment to the artists themselves, the original artists themselves, or their estates. She staged a series of performances called Seven Easy Pieces, where she did just that. So she's kind of thinking through this kind of idea of reperformance. We also have appropriation artists or artists that are thinking about authorship and originality who use the idea of remixing or kind of re-editing work. So in this work by Dara Birnbaum, Technology Transformation Wonder Woman, she edits together in a very selective way footage from the Wonder Woman TV show. So she's always kind of bursting into flame or running her nails across a mirror or kind of coming into being through sparks and flame. And at the end of the video, it's a blue screen and the Wonder Woman theme song is translated into text and it scrolls as it's being sung. And you're made aware of just what kind of sexual framework a figure like Wonder Woman is put in. There are these kind of all these like oohs and ahs in the song. And it's a different way of kind of drawing our attention towards the way that, say, gender or sexuality is seen through popular culture. You also get artists who actually literally use mixtapes. So this is a contemporary choreographer, Jerome Bell, and his kind of showpiece, The Show Must Go On, which is literally a mix of, you know, about 24 songs played in their entirety with a group of both dancers and non-dancers, trained and non-trained dancers, and each song begets a different kind of action. So what you're looking at the top is when Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On plays. They kind of reenact the scene from Titanic as a group. And then down at the bottom, you'll see the, even if you don't know Reel to Reel, I bet you know the song I Like to Move It. I will do my version of it for you right now. No, I won't. I like to move it, right? But what each person does is do a specific movement over and over and over again. Some are comical, some are just outrageous, some are slightly boring. You know, there may be a person who just kicks their leg out like this, there may be another person who kind of shakes their belly. But they just perform this action over and over for the entirety of the song. So what happens in this performance is at once interesting and incredibly boring at the same time, because they're doing these actions for the entirety of the song, right? So whatever initial thrill you may get from it, suddenly you're waiting 2 minutes for the song to be over, right? And this is part of what Jerome Bell builds into his audience response. He wants his audiences to get restless a little bit, to be renewed and surprised every 3 minutes, right? So there's a kind of way that remixing or creating a mixtape plays with kind of this idea of originality or authorship as well. Another key kind of concern or theme that I want to address is media and medium, and I mean that in both senses of the term. So what are artists' materials, and also what's the role of kind of media in art, and popular media in art? So we're going to be kind of looking at the meaning of specific media, of a kind of dematerialization of an art object. What does new media mean anyway? And performance a little bit. Now, again, these are all really big questions. I'm just providing a little bit of background on each. So if you find an area that you feel is really interesting, I want you to take that and kind of do your own homework. Go and kind of find out a way that you can kind of investigate that further. So the work that I want to use from the show that's upstairs to kind of kick off this section is Chikaya Booker's Position Preferred. And I actually remember having interactions with Chikaya Booker's works at Oberlin, where I went to school. They had purchased one of her works. She mostly, almost exclusively, works in the media of rubber tires, bike tires, car tires, any manner of kind of rubber tire. And she makes sculptures that range in size from yay big to kind of large, wall-sized installations, sculptural, almost monumental installations out of tire. What you have in your collection now, because of the Contemporary Collectors Forum, is actually a really interesting example of Chikaya Booker's work, because it is meant to really be seen. It's not a solely wall-based work. It's meant to be seen in kind of a more three-dimensional way, and it has a kind of presence that's at once kind of almost humanoid or kind of animal-like, and that's not always the case with Chikaya Booker's work. So to me, it kind of looks like a mohawk or maybe a hedgehog or something. But what I really associate with Chikaya Booker's work, besides any kind of reading out of abstract content that we might want to do, is I remember being surrounded by Chikaya Booker's work at one of her retrospectives and how the gallery smelled, which was like rubber, right? And this is really, this is actually a really interesting intervention, I think, and something that that to me has to be somewhat intentional, which is that it brings an unfamiliarity or an unfamiliar smell into the gallery, a smell that we might associate with industrialization, a smell that we might associate with transportation and maybe the more mundane aspects of our life. And yet she takes that material, she takes that set of olfactory associations and totally recombines them and totally manipulates them to speak to issues as diverse as, say, the African diaspora. So the way that objects move across spaces and across Atlantic spaces, Pacific spaces, right? Or just kind of formal qualities. I think it can be both. I think it can have an intrinsic kind of social context as well as an intrinsic formal context as well. So this is an example of an artist who's using a very specific media to draw out very specific ideas about culture at large. So some people talk about the way that the tire treads look like kind of scarification marks on African sculpture, or the way that the lines indicate something about textile and textile design. She is someone who's very invested in textile and textile design. So there is this kind of way that the material itself can speak about the work. This is especially true when you look at works that seem to take up a similar form but are made from different materials. So maybe the classic example would be a minimalist cube by Donald Judd. And then we might take a more recent example by Rebecca Warren. This is actually, it looks like it's plaster that's been spray painted gold. It's actually cast bronze. And you see the way that the artists treat these materials differently, whereas the Donald Judd is meant to be set on the floor to become a part of its kind of cubic surroundings, the Rebecca Warren is put on a piece of plywood, on a set of casters, which, as you'll note, actually make it much harder to maneuver, right? It's not just four casters on the corner. There are lots of casters in the middle of that plywood plank. Right? So there seems to be at once a kind of heaviness to the material if you know that it's bronze, or a kind of lightness if you don't know it's bronze. There seems to be an inability to move, or an invective to move. So really thinking about all of the materials that, say, a sculptor uses, a sculptor like Shekiah Booker or a sculptor like, say, Rachel Harrison, is worth kind of thinking about, especially when they jumble things together that don't seem to go together, right? Like, so what does a bicycle have to do with the picture of Mel Gibson, have to do with the picture, with a piece of fur, with these kind of purple-violet brickwork? I can't tell you with any clarity what particular meaning this piece has, or if there is one particular meaning. But there is this kind of relationship between the materials, the way that they hang, or the way that they kind of operate in space. The bike juts out of space. The kind of, there's this kind of wiper or pole that kind of holds this kind of hanging piece of fur with an image just clipped right onto it. So there's something here about the way that materials are attached, the way that they're collaged together, images from both pop culture, the internet, right, and kind of objects of Americana, bicycles, or brickwork. So it's a kind of collage or assemblage of materials that may actually produce an assemblage of meanings. There are also really charged materials. For example, I like to think about Teresa Margolyez's work. Margolyez was a part of a artist collective in Mexico, which was titled SEMAFO, after the actual organization SEMAFO in Mexico City, which is a forensic governmental organization that deals with unclaimed dead bodies. And what Teresa Margolyez does is that she works with SEMAFO to actually wash the corpses of unclaimed bodies. And she sees this as an act of kind of love and care with these bodies that otherwise go unclaimed and get very kind of impoverished burial sites. And then she takes that material, that kind of act, or whatever's left from that act of kind of wash and care, this water that's been used to wash these bodies, she sanitizes it and places it in installations. So what at first may appear to be this really lovely, wondrous kind of bubble wonderland is actually created with some of this water, right? So all of a sudden, it's not just a fact that I'm telling you. It's something that you have to deal with bodily, corporally, in space, right? You have to deal with the fact that here is the evidence of this kind of issue right in front of your face. And that she wraps it in such a kind of elegant package is a way of kind of making her point or her critique stronger, right? So if we know the material of this work, then we may be able to recover somewhat of maybe the political meanings behind this work. Now, artists have been dealing with this issue of material and kind of how much material do we use to make a work of art for a long time. In fact, we can think about conceptual artists like Saul LeWitt actually making works that are certificate-based. So for example, this Saul LeWitt wall drawing, and in fact, all of Saul LeWitt's wall drawings are certificate-based, which means that when you purchase the work of art, you actually purchase a certificate allowing you to reproduce it. So you don't actually buy or remove the drawing from the wall. You actually buy the certificate and then enact the drawing on the wall, right? So this is part of what a critic like Lucy Lepard or other kind of art historians of conceptual art call a kind of dematerialization of the art object, which means that the art object no longer has to be necessarily made of anything in particular. It can be an idea that gets kind of traded back and forth. There's no contemporary artist who I think exemplifies this maneuver or strategy better than Tino Segal. And actually, if I was being a good art historian, I wouldn't put any image up on this screen right now, because Tino Segal has a policy where his works cannot be photographs. And in fact, these are not photographs of his work. These are photographs of the Guggenheim Museum, where the work was staged. And then there's Tino Segal with some of his interlocutors down below. It was a picture made for a New York Times, I think, piece on Tino Segal. But what he does is he takes a work of art and he makes a performance, and there isn't even a certificate to trade. So to buy a work by Tino Segal, it's an oral contract between people. You have to stand in the room, and there's a financial and oral contract between folks. Now, that's a really interesting way of making art because it aligns art with oral history traditions instead of material traditions, right? So it asks us to consider what happens when art is passed down orally. Is there a way, what happens when we think about how to conserve an artwork like this, right? This artwork in particular, called This Progress, was realized in the Guggenheim Museum, and it consisted of viewers approaching, for those of you who know the Guggenheim Museum, there's this kind of central spiral ramp that Frank Lloyd Wright designed. Viewers approaching the ramp, about to kind of ascend the Guggenheim, and being approached by a small child, and asked by this child, "Hi, my name is blank, what is progress to you?" Right? And then the person either talks to that kid or kind of backs away slowly. But most people talk to that kid, and they would start walking up the ramp with you. So this kid would be kind of trained in kind of talking to all manner of people about their ideas of progress. They hand you off to someone who's a little bit older, say a teenager or someone in their younger 20s, repeats what you guys have just said to each other, hands you off, and you continue up the ramp with this person. And then they hand you off to an older person, and all the way up to the top, whereas when you reach the top of the ramp, the person informs you that this has been This Progress by Tino Segal, 2010, thank you so much. And you're left to kind of wander the ramp back down, right? Now, it is kind of funny, but what people talk about with this work is just how involved they could get in conversations with people about what progress was. And it's not every day that you're asked to ruminate on something like that, or asked to kind of consider what it means to make an argument to, say, an 8-year-old versus a 50-year-old, right? And to try to continue on that conversation. So he's staging these kinds of interventions in spaces that are performative, but have no actual material. The actual work of art is the experience. We could say something similarly minded of Eduardo Kac's The Mystery of the Enigma, in which the artist actually worked with botanists to engineer his own DNA into a specific brand of plant. So this is the Edunia, and it carries the artist's DNA in those kind of red vein-like structures. The artwork itself is, I guess, the seeds, right? Or I guess the process of making the artist's own self, the artist's own body, replicable within another organic body. But there's no quote-unquote sculpture, so to speak, of. You could exhibit these as a kind of bank of edunias in a gallery, right? But even that doesn't kind of get quite to the heart of what the artistic project was here. Even things that look like they're sculptural may not actually be sculptural. So this is Carsten Haller's test site. It was produced for the Tate Modern in London for their kind of Turbine Hall, their Unilever series. And it consists of a series of slides from different levels of the museum down to the center space of Turbine Hall. Now, these things have a kind of sculptural presence. There is no doubt about it. So there is a kind of literal material here. But what happens when you kind of slide down a slide a couple stories, besides that you're inordinately terrified? Well, what happened is, and I will tell you because this is actually one of the few that I'm talking about today that I've actually kind of experienced in person, that when you are at the bottom of that space and you are watching people come out of these slides, that there is a kind of exuberance, loudness, happiness, giddiness in the gallery that you just don't typically see in art museums. Which leads me to actually question, is the artwork itself, these kind of massive slides and the engineering that takes place in these slides, or is it the kind of biological process of releasing endorphins, getting audience members to enjoy themselves despite themselves, right? It's an interesting question to ask, what is the material here? And in fact, part of this project was Carson Haller working with a group of architects to propose a building whose sole mode of transport down was slides, right? And the idea was is that it would greatly affect or greatly reinterpret office culture. Because if you were made to slide instead of take an elevator in a closed box, I mean, some people would not like that at all, and I get that. But the idea is that you would end up with a kind of giddier, happier, endorphin high workforce, right, at points during the day. That getting off of work is like, yippee, right? Literally, right? So I think the art object here is actually something other than the slides themselves. It may be the experience of sliding, which is not really a quote-unquote object per se, right? There is also this question of media and what new media is. Now, this is a kind of, this is an old chestnut of a question, and there are people who will tell you, well, new media is video. It's been a long time since that was kind of the radical answer, although people are just now coming around to it. And there's a way that video and film can actually intersect in ways that make us think about greater concepts. So, for example, this is Christian Marclay's The Clock, which is a 24-hour film of clips from other films of clocks in those films, and it actually tells the exact time at the time that it's being shown, right? So you can literally kind of watch this kind of montage from film history giving you the time, as it were, and it is engrossing. I mean, you would never just stare at a clock unless you're really bored at work, right? But, I mean, maybe, I don't know. But you want to watch this clock for hours and hours because you're watching Hitchcock, and then you're watching The Wizard of Oz, and then you're watching something else, right? So it's kind of like not just focusing on time, but focusing on film history as a medium. We also have media like digital and technological media, which computer media, which make it possible for artists to do things that we might not have considered before. So this is a project by the artist group AIDS3D, and these are water features that have a kind of inlaid computer chip within them. And when they're turned on, the extra computer space that's not being used to power the installation is donated to a work group that takes that computer energy and puts it towards things like cancer research and Alzheimer's research. So while you're looking at this work, when you've plugged it in and you're using energy, you are also donating think space for researchers, basically, right? So this is a way of kind of artists intersecting with, say, a nonprofit or a research mode. You also have artists who deal with online realities. So this is a video project by Ava and Franco Matez called Freedom. It concerns these kind of massive multiplayer online games where people can kind of shoot at each other. And the artist here makes a pretty daring critique of our current wars in the Middle East. So the artist sits and types out messages to her fellow players that says, what are we fighting for? Why are you shooting me? What are we fighting for? Where are we? What's going on? And what keeps happening is she keeps getting shot over and over and over and over again. And the first couple times, it's kind of funny, but then it kind of gets really upsetting really fast, right? So whatever pleasure was in this media is kind of evacuated out. So I'm going to briefly touch on a few works. I'm going to skip past some slides so that we have some good time for questions. But I'm going to briefly touch on a couple of the works from the collection in terms of identity politics and in terms of desire. So this work by Whitfield Lovell entitled Cakewalk not only intersects with kind of historical representations of African Americans within the United States, but also with performance traditions and ways of kind of speaking back. So what Whitfield Lovell does is he, on planks, on salvaged plank wood, he kind of draws these realist portraits of kind of anonymous pictures or pictures from families, and then he'll place these in kind of various installations, title them with very resonant titles. So a cakewalk, for example, is a series of traditions that began in the antebellum South, that began on plantations, and historians are actually torn about its origins and its uses, but the most compelling evidence I've found for it and the most compelling narrative I've found for it is that it was a way initially for slaves who had very, meaning no, rights at all, to kind of speak back or parody the people who owned them. So it was a way of kind of creating an embodied performance where they would kind of put on the airs, manners, and graces of the white society which enslaved them and parodied it. Now, what's so interesting about the cakewalk is that it gets co-opted by white culture, and it becomes part of things like minstrel shows in the late 19th century and in the early 20th century. So it becomes a kind of hinge point within a minstrel show of white actors and sometimes black actors as well, in blackface, performing this kind of parodic dance, right? So what Whitfield Lovell has done here is he's taken this kind of highly charged term and this kind of idea of walking and kind of drawn our attention towards walking with help, with kind of the aged, the kind of cane that's used once we kind of find ourselves amongst an aging population. So not only talking about kind of how an African-American population is aging, but how a concept like the cakewalk ages, and sometimes ages poorly, right, based on its kind of context and its usage and who kind of co-opts it. I'm going to skip past a few slides here, and I want to kind of put our attention on Roger Shimomura's artwork from the show upstairs. Another kind of major thematic that I wanted to kind of highlight was the kind of thematic of desire and history. And I see this actually reflected in the show itself, in the desire to collect images, and the desire to kind of have an investment in images. And actually, that's reflected itself in Roger Shimomura's painting, in which he represents himself in the center. He's represented as, it's actually this a character from a specific kind of Japanimation. But you can tell that it's the artist because he's got his kind of like his circular frames and a paintbrush in his hand. And he's surrounded by all of these kind of markers of manga and Japanimation culture. So we've got, you know, the Powerpuff Girls and Sailor Moon. And Shimomura, who was born and raised at least the first part of his life in Japanese internment camps, often makes work that kind of reflects on the marginal position of Asian Americans in United States culture. But what's so interesting about this work is it's one of his most kind of, I think, unabashedly jubilant pictures. So it's the artist kind of bursting out with all of these kind of cultural reference, this kind of collection of cultural images as he kind of moves out of the picture plane. I want to say, and I want to close with a little bit about kind of how I intersect. How I intersect with the kind of history of contemporary art, and that is primarily through kind of thinking about desire. So my own work is about sexual subcultures. So it's about groups of largely gay and lesbian men from the 1970s on. And what I find so fascinating about studying this at this point in time is that contemporary art and contemporary art institutions are for the first time becoming attuned to the products made by these kind of sexual subcultures in a very, I think, sometimes earnest, sometimes maybe not so earnest way. So a maker like Tom of Finland, who's been well known within kind of queer subcultures for a long time, is suddenly being collected by the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And what does that mean? Right, that drawings that were created for a specific kind of audience for a specific purpose are now being kind of collected and branded kind of museum quality art. Now, there are contemporary artists who kind of look at that history of desire and make interventions there. So, for example, Dean Samashima takes erotic connect the dots and kind of rescreens them on canvases so they're just this kind of tanglement of dots and numbers. So you can't even make a picture out of what he's screened there. Or someone like Monica Maggioli, who creates a very limited amount of work throughout her career, has begun a series of small oil paintings of ex-lovers reflected in black glass. And she's paired that with small abstract works of kind of abstract space and light, which are made and painted from lithographic ink. Her father was a lithographer, and these women that she depicts are kind of ex-lovers. So there's this kind of matrix of kind of familial and kind of lover desire here, all rendered with this kind of very subtle kind of black tonality. So I want to close by kind of returning to this crucifix and thinking about kind of my position in relationship to contemporary art, which is that, you know, I didn't have to believe in Christ to believe that this was art, right? I didn't have to believe in Christian ideals to know and recognize this as something that was made for a specific audience and a specific purpose. And I think actually that lesson can be applied again, that you don't have to actually believe in what it is that you're looking at. You don't have to kind of... you don't have to have the relationship where you, with contemporary art, where you necessarily have to be its greatest adherent, but you do have to try to understand it, right? And there are many ways that artists are communicating and reaching out, and I think having conversations. And I guess if there's a kind of thesis to this talk, to this crash course, which crash courses usually don't have arguments, they don't have theses, but if there's an argument here, it's that to engage in the conversation, right? I've given you a bunch of artists. I've given you a bunch of ways that artists engage in the process of making art. Your task now is to take that and kind of do with it what you will. So thanks for having me here, and I really appreciate it. Okay? Yeah. Thanks. So we have a little bit of time for questions, and I would really love to hear your thoughts. I've just been doing this to your head for a little bit. So we've got a mic, I think, and a mic runner. So if you have a question, raise your hand. Oh, good, I can see you. Thanks.
How do you react to the word inappropriate when it's applied to art?
What do you mean? Do you have something in mind in particular? Or?
When museums or... government city-sponsored yeah. museums say they don't want a certain type right. of art because it's inappropriate.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that question is bound up in a lot, and I think actually it depends on who you ask what is considered inappropriate. So, and I think the baseline tends to be, least challenging. Right, so I think like there is artwork that pushes boundaries either in terms of its content, and this can be in terms of sexual content, but also in terms of kind of violent or content that remarks upon a history of racism, for example. And people may find that inappropriate. And I think that while I do come from a museum education background initially, I think it's important for people to be confronted with what they deem inappropriate. No, it's okay. I think it's important for people to be confronted with that question because I think that's when we grow. So when I am confronted with an image that I don't understand, my impulse is not to discard it, but to actually figure it out more. And so I understand that museums have to do and make concessions and have to speak to audiences, and they also struggle financially, and that's a part of the equation too. And so I'm very attuned to that. As an art historian, I get to put those concerns a little aside and kind of say what happens when we face that kind of head on. So did that kind of answer your question? Okay, okay. Yeah, there's a question here. Hold on 1 second. I think they want you to have the mic. I know, but I think they're like recording this or something.
Okay.
So be prepared.
I'm ready.
Yeah, okay.
How do you think contemporary art is going to change the gender gap that we see in museums? Because right now I would say it's 95% men on the wall. So how do you think contemporary art is going to change that?
Well, I mean, okay. So this is a question that's kind of about history and about systems, and it's about... the ways that, in many respects, financially, educationally, formally, Women are or are not encouraged, and I would add people of color are or are not encouraged to participate in kind of a world of art making. And I think that in terms of a Western art history canon, there's a lot of redressing to do. So there is kind of this feeling that it is insurmountable. What I see today is actually, I find it incredibly affirming and hopeful in regards to women, in regards to queers, in regards to people of color. I find that many more people in my classes, and at Texas State I largely teach studio kids. There isn't a big kind of contingent of art history kids, that the majority of kids I teach are Latina, are female, are of color. And I think that, the only way that that begins to change is really by encouraging and also in the classroom showing examples of art that are not just kind of made by white men or white women. I think like that has a place as well, but it's a whole system of things. And so it seems like an impossible task, but I do think that it is and has been rapidly changing. It's kind of like, I do think that it's kind of like that Nina Simone song, it's too slow, right? And I get frustrated with how slow that process moves, but I think that it is happening. So contemporary artists are the ones who start to change that, I think, ultimately. But that's just my opinion. Any other questions? Maybe time for one more, if there's one more out there. Yes, there's one right here. Being passed the mic. Hi.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thanks.
You've brought up a lot of very interesting things in terms of the context and the history of a particular work. For example, with Drain, I would have been one of those ones that goes, And now I see it in a whole different light, but I don't have that kind of background.
Right, correct.
And I don't have that kind of history or context.
Right.
I do read, the plaques in the museum, but they don't always provide the kind of background and texture that you're talking about. How does one go about getting that?
So the way that I did it is I just started going to the library. I mean, the way that I did it was I would see something challenging, and now it's a lot easier because we can hop onto Google, and we can kind of, it's facilitated in a way that's much, I think it's much easier now to do that than if I was answering this question 20 years ago. But the way that I actually learned about this stuff and started to care about this stuff was sitting with it and spending alone time with books that were written about the artist, articles that were written about the artist. And it's only through that process that I think you come to have a kind of richer coloration of what it is that you're kind of looking at. I get this all the time. My family are not artists at all. My mom's a lawyer. My dad's a chemist. My mom was a government lawyer, by the way, so she was not like a legal eagle. She was always really comfortable behind a desk. They were not art-trained people. And in fact, I didn't live in a household that was very art-excitable, right? I get this from them all the time. They say, okay, that's great that you know that, but how do I get to know that? And actually, the boundary is so permeable, it's not a wall. It's like this thin scrim, because all it is it's actually kind of making the move to kind of go out, and instead of, say, watching Family Guy on Netflix or something, right, actually like Googling Robert Gober and kind of seeing what shows has he had. Are there online articles that I can access? And some of this is actually a question about resources. So in an academic context, you have a lot more kind of quote-unquote resources to pull from. But some of it's not. I mean, public libraries sometimes have really surprising and really lovely collections of art books, and then the internet as well. I mean, I think that's really how you start. I would return to the crucifix. Like, I knew nothing about who this dude, like, I didn't understand, like, why all these people were around him and not helping him down, and, like, I didn't get why, like, people were wailing and he wasn't yet dead. Like, I just didn't understand it, And for me to get to that point involved going to the image instead of expecting the image to tell me everything that I was supposed to know. And I think the reason why I tell that story, and I start with that story, or I lead with that story, is I think it points to the way that we are a culture to see, or that we are encouraged to see in specific ways by context. So my Christian friends knew exactly what that was, right? I didn't. So I think it's actually kind of stepping out and taking the next step, I think. So does that answer your question? It's a little rambly of an answer, but I tend to do that, you know, so. All right, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And please see the show.